Good morning. We'll start with some announcements. This one from Jerry Flaccus. Some kind soul cut up a branch of a tree on the corner of Kay and Grace Drive for us. Would a couple more kind souls help me haul the wood to the fire pit area after today's service? See Jerry. And after the service today, we'll have a picnic lunch available of burgers and dogs, and I saw salad and other goodies. There's no charge for this, but if you are so inclined, there will be a container for contributions. And during the summer, there is no formal religious education. Children are welcome in the service. However, if restlessness strikes, there will be supervised activities in the social hall for children to go to if they wish. One of the ways that we give to the larger community is by supporting local food pantries. We do this both with cash contributions and by the donation of non-perishable foods. I see that I have forgotten to put out the basket, so if you have brought non-perishable foods, during the prelude, you can bring them down and put them in the imaginary basket that I am now sitting down over there. Announcement that gives me great pleasure is that the budget that was approved for this new church year that began yesterday includes money for the worship arts to buy a subscription to the Touchstones Project. Now, this is a project out of the Western region which, among other things, will give us a monthly journal on a theme that will be sent to every member and friend of LCUUC. The Worship Arts Committee will be able to use these themes in our service planning, and we hope that you will find them a meaningful source of spiritual nourishment. I have used these journals at the Valley UU in Arizona and really like them. In fact, I have shared the ones that I have in my library with Worship Arts, and the next four services will be based on four of those journals. Next week, did my mic go off? Okay. Next week, Christy Bowden and Lois Remikus will be doing a service called Balancing Act, and I hope that you will be able to join us. Our sermon today was written by Reverend Dr. Michael A. Schuller, parish minister at First Unitarian Church in Madison. Please take a moment to turn off any electronics that you may have with you here today. Thank you.
We shan't give up the fight, we have only started, we have only started, we have only started. We shall not give up the fight, we have only started, we have only started, we have only started. Together we'll have victory, hand holding hand, hand holding hand, hand holding hand. Together we'll have victory, hand holding hand, hand holding hand. Hand holding hand, no, give up the fight we have. have only started. We have only started. We have only started. We shall not give up the fight. We have only started. We have only started. We have only started.
These truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. In 2017, we know that what the founders proclaimed in 1776 didn't really apply to every human being. It didn't apply to women. It didn't apply to slaves. And it didn't apply to the poor. But it was a promise we struggle to fulfill. On Independence Day, we celebrate that promise. Come, let us worship together, celebrating our freedom to think about our freedom. Please take a moment to say hello or to introduce yourself to the people around you this morning.
We light this chalice in memory of the courage of those who have struggled for freedom, the persistence of those who have struggled for justice, and the love of those who have built beloved communities to carry on the light of hope. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our opening hymn, number 148 in the gray hymnal, Let Freedom Span Both East and West.
Thank you.
Welcome to Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we strive to bring a message of hope and grace to an imperfect world. My name is Sue Andrews. Gus Santo and I will be leading your worship this morning. This morning, we will think a bit about what freedom has and hasn't meant for these United States. And perhaps we will think about our freedoms and the constraints we place upon them. We value freedom of speech and say, let reason and conscience be your guide in deciding what to believe. But I suspect we are much less permissive when it comes to derogatory speech. Speech which is designed to humiliate. Speech which denies and denigrates the inherent dignity of every person. As a UUA recognized welcoming congregation, we say, love whom you will. Be the gender you feel yourself to be. You are welcome here. And the freedom to be welcoming is one of our most cherished freedoms. Please join us for burgers and dogs after the service and conversation. I think they're setting up outside, but will the serving be done in the cafeteria? I think the servers are busily setting up.
It is inside.
Inside.
And we also have a vegetarian option.
Oh.
Vegetarian sloppy joes.
And that is a freedom. We are so very glad that you have chosen to be here to worship and to celebrate with us today.
Each April, we are reminded that freedom is not free, and that we are not free to decline our responsibility, our obligation to pay taxes. Each Sunday, we take a few minutes for the ritual of the offering. It is a reminder that the free church is not free. It is a celebration of contributions we make in talent, in time, in financial support to the life and work of this community. Let us pass these baskets thoughtfully. Even if you fulfill your pledge via the magic of the internet, you have and are pouring so many gifts of service into a figurative offering basket. The morning offering will now be given and received. for these gifts, given and received for the work of this community. One of the reasons that we come together in beloved community here is to share our laughter and our tears, and we do this in several ways. Before the service, you are always welcome to silently light a candle on the candle table, and during the service, we speak aloud, and the worship associate lights candles for us. So would anyone who has a joy or a concern to share, please raise your hand, and the ushers will bring you a microphone. Please limit it to a few sentences so that everyone who needs to can speak and has the time to share. And you may do so now.
Well, I have one joy, or a couple joys, actually. First one being that construction is closed down for the weekend. I'm not at work, so it's kind of nice. And seriously, a joy is that getting together with the family this weekend has been great.
Bev here. I would ask you to light a candle of concern for what some might consider a trivial issue, but a beloved family member who just happens to be canine is facing a serious medical issue, and as her mom, I'm having to make a difficult decision. Thanks for your concern.
This is Jim. If you would hold my youngest nephew, Jeffrey, in your light. He is, lung cancer has now spread to his brain, so the outlook is not as hopeful as it was.
And we light the last candle for those joys and sorrows which we hold deeply, but which have not been named here today.
Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming, oh yes I know. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming. Freedom is coming, freedom is coming, freedom is coming.
It was during those long and lonely years that my hunger for the freedom of my own people became a hunger for the freedom of all people, white and black. I knew as well as I knew anything that the oppressor must be liberated just as surely as the oppressed. A man who takes away another man's freedom is a prisoner of hatred. He is locked behind the bars of prejudice and narrow-mindedness. I am not truly free if I am taking away someone else's freedom, just as surely as I am not free when my freedom is taken from me. The oppressed and the oppressor alike are robbed of their humanity. When I walked out of prison, that was my mission, to liberate the oppressed and the oppressor both. Some say that has now been achieved, but I know that that is not the case. The truth is that we are not yet free. We have merely achieved the freedom to be free, the right not to be oppressed. We have not taken the final step of our journey, but the first step on a longer and even more difficult road. For to be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others. The true test of our devotion to freedom is just beginning. I have walked the long road to freedom. I have tried not to falter. I have made missteps along the way, but I have discovered that the secret that after climbing a great hill, one finds that there are many more hills to climb. I have taken a moment here to rest, to steal a view of the glorious vistas that surround me, to look back on the distance I have come. But I can rest only for a moment, for with freedom comes responsibilities, and I dare not linger, for my long walk, is not yet ended.
Let these words by Pearl Buck guide us into a few moments of silent thought, meditation, or the spirit of prayer. None who have been free can understand the terrible, fascinating power of the hope of freedom to those who are not free. This reading, The Turquoise Patriot, is an excerpt from a sermon by Victoria Safford, minister at White Bear UU in Minnesota. A child I know, when asked whether she would answer the call of her elementary school principal to wear red, white, and blue clothes to school on Thursday, was in a quandary. She put down the crayon with which she was painstakingly trying to squeeze the words "peace is possible" on the white bars between the red bars on the small American flag she had made, and said, "Well, it is a pretty good country, so it's hard to know what to wear. This is a pretty good country. It is one of hundreds and hundreds of pretty good countries, layered relatively recently onto the skim of topsoil or desert sand or water that covers our globe. It is one of hundreds of pretty good countries filled with millions of pretty good and proud and worthy people. These lands, too, with sunlight and clover. It is a pretty good but pretty complicated country, where lately I, who am a lifelong citizen, feel even more than usual like an alien, afraid that if I speak, my voice might not betray some foreign origin, but the uneven geography of my heart. It is hard to know what to wear and to say. These days, everywhere I go with anyone I meet, I'm wondering, where are you coming from, friend? With your black armband, with your flag, with your red, white, and blue clothing, with your peace sign, with your tears. What roads have you traveled to reach the place where you are? In our pretty good country, it is an honor and a privilege to answer, and in turn to ask, what are we really loyal to? What usefulness can nationalism serve now as the old world yields to a new century? What is America's right relation and right role and my right role as a citizen? And what are you going to wear? The child found her own remarkable response. When asked what she thought she'd like to do, she did say, "It's a pretty good country." And she looked up then for confirmation of that claim, for some assurance that this guess might in fact be true. And this I gladly gave her. She knows I have my doubts, but needs to be reminded, just as I do, that they go hand in hand with hopes and dreams so passionate, so powerful. And then she said, deeply serious and without seeking my collaboration or permission, "I think I'm going to wear turquoise, pink, and beige for now." And so she did. And I don't know if she knows what risk might be entailed there, what wrath she may incur among her playmate, her playground comrades, or her teachers, or her principal, or how her own chosen symbols of ambivalence might be misunderstood. I don't know what confidence she may inspire in this country to which she has not yet learned at her young age to pledge allegiance. For now, she is a turquoise patriot. She's proud and scared and questioning. Her allegiance is to her own conscience, and her trust is, for now, with the adults in whose clumsy hands her entire future is contained. Here ends the reading. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing Building Bridges, number 1023, in the Teal Hymnal.
I doubt that any concept has greater currency among Americans than freedom and its synonym, liberty. It is prominent in the Pledge of Allegiance, which ensures justice and liberty for all, in the Star-Spangled Banner, which characterizes the United States as a land of the free and home of the brave, and in the words of practically every politician as they pay lip service to the concept while vying for public office or promoting legislation. Given the premium that U.S. culture has placed on freedom, it is hardly surprising that a faith tradition such as the Unitarian Universalism would have arisen within it. Thomas Jefferson once described Unitarianism as the religion most in harmony with the democratic, freedom-loving American spirit. Drawn by its anti-creedal, non-dogmatic, and democratic principles, generations of freethinkers have entered our movement's ranks, including such notables as Susan B. Anthony, champion of women's rights, Roger Baldwin, the founder of the American Civil Liberties Union, and John Haynes Holmes, co-founder of the NAACP. As the late Stephen Fritchman, a Unitarian minister whose Los Angeles church provided a spiritual refuge for actors and writers caught up in the anti-communist crusade of the early 1950s, put it, "Unitarians are men and women of the free spirit. No party has us in its pocket. No dictator writes our creed, and no monolithic power robs us of our native strength to say, the king is wrong. We are a people braced by centuries of freedom, who love maturity and despise all meek surrender to those in search of witches." End quote. Nevertheless, freedom has often been a vexed word, a source of both confusion and conflict. If I have heard it once, if I have said it once, I have heard it 1,000 times. As a Unitarian Universalist, I can believe anything I want. But while it is true that our faith tradition encourages freedom of inquiry and allows for much greater latitude in belief than is typical for religion, it most certainly does not say that anything goes, nor does it imply that any one belief is as acceptable or as valid as another. To hold such a position is to misconstrue freedom. The fact is, Unitarian Universalism would be completely stripped of all moral and theological substance if freedom was conceived and practiced in this way. As former Unitarian Universalist Association president Dana Greeley wrote, "Just to advocate freedom in religion does not of itself constitute a religion." To be sure, for Unitarian Universalists, the right of conscience is accorded high value. It is embedded in the fifth of our 7 principles. But the 4th principle, which calls for a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, puts the 5th in proper context and helps us distinguish between freedom and mere license. The latter, license, tolerates no restrictions, rejects intelligent discernment, and demands absolute autonomy. No matter that my belief is ill-founded, irrational, and pernicious, it is my categorical right to claim it, license says. Freedom, on the other hand, is ever and always subject to certain limits, the dictates of reason, perhaps, or the necessity of living in a community, or of ensuring our own and other people's safety. As Barack Obama put it in his acceptance speech at the 208th Democratic Convention, "What is the American promise? It's a promise that says each of us has the freedom to make of our own lives what we will, and that we also have obligations to treat each other with dignity and respect. But just as Unitarian Universalists have not always been clear about or in agreement over what freedom means and what it implies, neither has the rest of the country. Although Americans have been blessed with a commendable record on freedom, we are also burdened with a long history of hesitancy and inconsistency when it comes to putting that principle into practice. The struggle to determine freedom's meaning and establish its parameters commenced with the arrival of the first religious refugees in the early 17th century. The Puritans had hardly established a beachhead in Massachusetts before their leaders began placing severe restraints on religious faith and practice. Thus, John Winthrop, the first governor of the colony, distinguished sharply between, quote, natural liberty, which suggested the liberty to do evil, and, quote, moral liberty, or the liberty to do only what is good. In keeping with that distinction, 17th century Puritan minister Jonathan Boucher defined true liberty as a liberty to, quote, do everything that is right and being restrained from doing anything that is wrong, end quote. Now, these pious settlers arrived here with an understanding of freedom that has its origins in the writings of ancient authorities, such as Aristotle and St. Augustine. For them, as for the Puritans, freedom and morality were indissolubly connected. As Augustine put it, he that is good is free, though he be but a slave. He that is evil is a slave, though he be a king. Those among the early settlers who desired a less restrictive and more open spiritual atmosphere, Roger Williams and Anne Hutchinson, for example, were ultimately forced to leave the colony. The point is, both of these factions valued freedom, but they simply could not reach a consensus on what it meant and how it ought to be properly exercised. Americans have also struggled for centuries over who is entitled to freedom and who is not. Democratic freedom, the right to have a say in matters of politics and governance, was initially restricted to white men who owned property. At the time of the Revolution, only property owners were believed to be cultured enough and to have a sufficient stake in public policy to act responsibly. Wage labor was associated with servility and immaturity. Thomas Jefferson, for one, felt differently, which is why the right to property disappeared from the Declaration of Independence and the pursuit of happiness was inserted instead. By the time of Jefferson's death on July 4, 1826, which happened to be the 50th anniversary of the Declaration, property was no longer a requirement for voting or holding office in most states. Both slavery and industrialization afford vivid examples of just how complex debates over freedom have been. For defenders of slavery, property rights and local control were at stake. The right to property, Virginia's Arthur Lee argued, is the guardian of every other right, and to deprive a people of this is to deprive them of their liberty. One might well ask, as some did, what gives one man the right to claim another as property? To which slavery's defenders replied, white men were made for liberty. Blacks, on the other hand, were regarded as utterly unqualified for rational freedom. They are perpetual children for whom freedom would be a curse. For abolitionists, the operative conditions of freedom were quite different. To have property in oneself and the right to possess the fruits of one's own labor is what mattered to them. when Frederick Douglass escaped from slavery and acquired his first paying job in Massachusetts, he declared, "I am now my own master." Douglass's wage was an emblem of his freedom. Here is how Abraham Lincoln contrasted these two views of freedom in 1864. "The world has never had a good definition of the word liberty, and the American people just now are much in want of one. We all declare for liberty, but in using the same word, we do not all mean the same thing. With some, the word liberty may mean for each man to do as he pleases with himself and the product of his labor, while with others, the same word may mean for some men to do as they please with other men and the product of other men's labor. Here are two not only different but incompatible things called by the same name, liberty," end quote. A similar dispute over the word freedom roiled the nation during the Gilded Age, when a new generation of industrialists and wage earners found themselves contending over its economic implications. The business community placed primary emphasis on freedom of contract. As long as labor relations and economic transactions were governed by contracts, independently arrived at by autonomous individuals, all was well. To the degree that labor unions and governments interfered with such contractual arrangements, freedom was at grave risk. For their part, workers and their advocates argued that the right to organize and to bargain collectively for decent wages ensured workers' freedom and protected them from becoming wage slaves. In an age of industrial and commercial giants, labor maintained that the negotiating positions of management and labor were hardly equal. As a culture, we have yet to resolve this issue. For many today, the locus of freedom par excellence is the marketplace with its myriad products available for anyone for the right price. As David Lilienthal, former chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, once declared, "By freedom, I mean essentially the freedom to choose to the maximum degree possible. It means a maximum range of choice for the consumer when he spends his dollar." I imagine more than a few Americans would agree wholeheartedly with Lilienthal, and it is why they are often willing to accept oppressive work environments as the price for exercising freedom of choice in the marketplace. If asked to identify which dimension of freedom matters most, what percentage of the U.S. population would choose consumer sovereignty over civil liberties or democratic freedom? I suspect many would opt for the former, but not Dorothy Canfield Fisher, who wrote, "Freedom is not worth fighting for if it means no more than license for everyone to get as much as they can for themselves. And freedom is worth fighting for, but it does mean something more than unrestricted grabbing." In recent decades, the struggle over variant understandings of freedom has hardly let up. In 1952, Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, a man of Unitarian sensibilities, opined that the right to be left alone is the beginning of all freedom. This set the stage for a series of right to privacy decisions handed down by the High Court in the years that followed. The right to use contraceptives, to seek an abortion, to cohabitate outside of marriage, and to enter into same-sex relationships all follow from the privacy principle. Yet for many social conservatives, this has been an unwelcome development. For those who still think of freedom in moral terms, its expansion into such traditionally sensitive areas is patently offensive. Like those old Puritan divines, our modern moralists equate liberty with an inner disposition to do only what is righteous and godly. As a morally freighted concept, freedom, writes historian Eric Foner, has been used to convey and claim legitimacy for all kinds of grievances and hopes, fears about the present, and visions of the future. What that suggests is that we need to exercise great care in using the word and insist on a certain precision when we hear it mentioned. Americans are suckers for freedom. The popularity of politicians rests upon it. The wars we fight are justified by it. Advertisers shamelessly exploit it, and it is an ever-present factor in how members of families and communities relate to each other. As an American and as a person of privilege, I cherish it as much as the next person. And as a Unitarian Universalist, it probably means more to me than to most. But in the end, I have learned that the choice we have before us isn't whether or not to defend and promote freedom per se. It is the much more difficult one of determining which of our freedoms really matter and are most worthy of our loyalty. Amen.
Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our closing hymn this week as rousingly as you can. This land is your land. The words are in the insert in your order of service.
This land is your land, this land is mine.
Go in peace. Embraced by the light and warmth of our gathering, go in love, ready to struggle on. Go in beauty, shining forth like a lamp for freedom. Amen and blessed be. Yeah.